Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
Affirmative action has benefited women more than any other group, and I think that's another piece that people tend to forget.
Alaskans' leading diversity initiatives gauge the Supreme Court's ruling on affirmative action. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, July 13th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, forecasts paint a dire picture of the spendable part of the Alaska Permanent Fund.
There's lots of things that can change, but it is a warning light on the state's fiscal dashboard.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Alaska Air Cargo, serving the commerce and business needs of 20 Alaska communities, from Adak to Barrow to Ketchikan. More information at alaskacargo.com.
And by
Princess Lodges, offering glass-domed railcar tours to Talkeetna and Denali National Park for Alaska summer adventures. Your journey begins at princesslodges.com.
Since the U.S. Supreme Court struck down affirmative action practices at public and private universities, Alaskans on the forefront of diversity initiatives have been assessing the impacts. As KNBA's Rhonda McBride found out, the court's decision has left them with a lot to consider.
As both an African-American and a longtime public servant, Senator L.V. Gray Jackson has fought against racism. She calls the U.S. Supreme Court's affirmative action ruling a gut punch.
It was unbelievable. We're going backwards instead of moving forward.
She worries that employers will apply the court's reasoning to the workplace.
Folks are already marginalized, people of color, and I think this is going to make it even worse.
The Supreme Court ruled the admissions policies at Harvard and the University of North Carolina are unconstitutional because they violate the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause. The decision, though, doesn't affect the University of Alaska system because of its open admissions policy, in which almost everyone who applies gets accepted. But Diane Hirschberg, director of the university's Institute of Social and Economic Research, finds the popularity of the ruling disturbing.
One of the concerns I have about the anger towards affirmative action is people are not recognizing what it's trying to rectify.
Hirschberg says affirmative action levels the playing field beyond race.
Affirmative action has benefited women more than any other group, and I think that's another piece that people tend to forget.
For Alaska Native corporations, which have invested heavily in education, the decision is discouraging. Since their formation, 12 regional corporations have collectively handed out more than $100 million in scholarships. And that doesn't include village corporations on the North Slope, like the Ukpiakovic Inupiat Corporation. Its president and CEO, Pearl Brower, says the corporation has grown to 60 companies.
We employ about 3,600 people in almost every state in the nation.
Many of those jobs go to Alaska Natives and include executives who have attended prestigious schools. Brower worries the court's decision will reverse the big gains made in Native hire.
No matter where you look, you don't ever see an Indigenous person in the forefront. They are already so underrepresented.
And yet, Brower has seen a lot of progress in her lifetime. Before she became president at Ukpiakovic, she was director of the Ilisavik College and most recently oversaw the University of Alaska's diversity initiatives for Alaska Natives.
At the core, what all of this does is really provide just more opportunity for everyone.
For both minorities and majorities. Rosita Worrell, head of the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute, says research shows that diversity fosters creativity and open-mindedness, an asset for companies who need workers comfortable communicating across different cultures. But in the wake of the ruling, Worrell expects college admissions for Alaska Natives to drop.
To me, it's just so unfathomable that the Supreme Court did that.
But Worrell is pleased with the court's other decision last month to uphold the Indian Child Welfare Act.
The individuals who brought the ICWA case were saying that it was racial discrimination, but the Supreme Court ruled, no, it wasn't racial discrimination because the rights that we hold are political rights.
Political rights that Worrell says could have bearing on the court's affirmative action ruling. She says Sea Alaska attorneys have begun an intensive legal review on behalf of hundreds of students currently on Sea Alaska scholarships.
I'm hopeful that we'll be able to get word out to universities that because of our political status, affirmative action can be applied to Native American admissions to colleges.
Alex Cleghorn, an attorney at the Alaska Native Justice Center, says it's yet to be seen if Native American political status can be tied to affirmative action. But he worries about future interpretations of the court's ruling and their impact on equal opportunity programs.
I know that I benefited not just from admissions in that program, but additional support around succeeding in the school.
Cleghorn says it's risky to forecast where future U.S. Supreme Court rulings will go, but says it's maddening to watch the very same courts issue two decisions so diametrically opposed.
This has been true throughout history. So the same U.S. Supreme Court that decided Brown versus Board of Education was the same Supreme Court that decided Tahiton in the Southeast.
While the 1954 Brown decision banned racial segregation, Cleghorn says the Tahiton ruling a year later was blatantly racist, that it not only denied Tlingits compensation for their land and sale of their timber, but was written in language steeped in prejudice.
So the quote is, "Every American schoolboy knows that the savage tribes of this continent were deprived of their ancestral ranges by force, and that even when the Indians ceded millions of acres by treaty in return for blankets, food, and trinkets, it was not a sale, but the conqueror's will that deprived them of their land."
Cleghorn says the U.S. Supreme Court, both then and now, has moments that inspire, others that are regrettable. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
Alaska Permanent Fund staff presented a forecast this week that, under a worst-case scenario, shows the spendable portion of the fund is shrinking and could be used up within 3 years. Amid declining oil revenue, state lawmakers have depended on a transfer from that spendable part of the fund, called the Earnings Reserve, to pay for government services and permanent fund dividends. Alaska Beacon reporter James Brooks says the forecast, presented at a regular quarterly meeting yesterday, is yet another warning about a problem with high stakes for Alaska.
We're not at a point of panic yet. There's lots of things that can change, but it is a warning light on the state's fiscal dashboard. This is likely to be the second straight year where the permanent fund has failed to earn enough money to compensate for withdrawals from the fund.
Gotcha. And remind us how that works. How does the state use that? How does it get depleted? I mean, like, why are we in this situation?
Yeah. So back in 2018, after oil prices and production and oil revenue collapsed, legislature realized it needed to act. And so what it did was it said, set up a system where each year the permanent fund transfers a rolling 5% average of the fund's value to the state treasury. That money can be used for dividends, it could be used for services, it's not pegged to any specific item. This year and for the past few, it's been about $3 billion. And that money is by far the largest source of general purpose revenue for the state. It's bigger than oil, it's bigger than all other taxes, and we should point out that this is not a problem that the Permanent Fund Corporation itself can solve. This is a political problem at its core. The legislature has been spending more from the permanent fund than the permanent fund is earning.
So back to those forecasts, are there, I guess, timelines there that they're worried about that we would run out of that money?
Based on this projection, it looks like 3 to 4 years down the line, we're looking at the summer of 2026, summer of 2027, based on these projections. And it's important to note again, these are just projections. If investment returns are better, if inflation is lower, if the legislature changes the amount it's spending or the amount it's locking away in the protected part of the permanent fund, that timeline can change.
And I guess I wonder, you know, considering all that, how big of a deal this is, this report with these forecasts in it. I mean, I guess one of the members of the permanent fund board said, quote, "It's a big deal" in your story. How big of a deal is it, though?
If things don't change, this is the biggest deal. The annual transfer from the permanent fund accounts for more than half of the state's general purpose revenue. That's money for schools, that's money for roads, that's money for dividends. If that money goes away, suddenly you've got a $3 billion hole in a $6 billion budget. And it's going to take a lot to fill that hole.
So James, you know, what comes next?
There's lots of potential solutions out there. The Board of Trustees ordered staff to start looking at some potential ideas, write up a discussion paper, what they call a trustee paper. And we'll see the results of that later this fall in September. The permanent fund's paying attention to the issue and is analyzing it and could make some recommendations for the legislature. But in the end, solving this is, if investments don't get better, it's going to be in the hands of the legislature and the governor.
That was Alaska Beacon reporter James Brooks. You can find his reporting at alaskabeacon.com. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, cold, wet conditions have delayed the harvest of Alaska peonies.
We're in uncharted territory right now. We've not had such a late season before.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
You know that eating fruits and vegetables supports good health. But did you also know that frozen and canned produce offers the same health benefits as fresh? It's true. Whether fresh, frozen, canned, or from the land, eating fruits and veggies can lead to a long and healthy life. So when it comes to getting the fruits and veggies you need to stay healthy, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by SNAP.
Alaska's Supreme Court, with support from the state's Bar Association, approved a waiver at the end of last year that will allow specially trained non-lawyers to represent Alaskans in court for some issues. The Alaska Beacon reports that Alaska Legal Services says the system is unique to Alaska, and that the non-lawyers with legal training are crucial because there is not enough legal representation in the state. The waiver is in place, but the volunteers have not started their work yet. Volunteers will have to undergo the training and be approved by the Alaska Bar Association to represent clients in court. The project is modeled on a partnership with the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium's Community Health Aid Program, which places health aides in remote communities. Nick Begich III is taking another run at a seat in the U.S. House. Begich is a 45-year-old Republican tech entrepreneur from a famous family of Democrats. He announced his 2024 campaign today. Begich also ran for U.S. House last year with a largely self-funded campaign that was punctuated by clashes with fellow Republican Sarah Palin. Begich finished in third place twice in 2022. Begich says he has reason to believe a different outcome is possible next year, especially because the House contest will be the only statewide race on the ballot other than the presidential race.
I think as Alaskans, we'll be able to spend more time digging in on the candidates and positions, and I think we've got a great opportunity.
Democrat Mary Peltola finished first, and Palin finished second in both the special general and the regular general elections of 2022. The ranked choice tabulations did not change that order. Peltola campaign manager Anton McParland says Peltola intends to show that she's been working for the betterment of Alaskans. He mentioned her support of the Willow Arctic Drilling Project and rural broadband expansion.
We hope that we are earning the trust of the Alaskans who voted for us, who voted for Mary, and we'll continue to do that for the next 16 months of this Congress.
Begich and other Republicans who may join the race are likely to get a boost from the national GOP. The Republican Party has targeted Peltola with multiple press releases tying her to the Biden administration and inflation, and attacking her voting record on hot-button issues like rights for transgender people. The Kenai Peninsula Borough Assembly is officially supporting a proposed statewide rule that would bar trans girls from women's high school sports, per a resolution passed at its meeting Tuesday night. As KDLL's Riley Board reports, the resolution had support from the Assembly and public, though some questioned the impact of its message and its relevance.
The resolution does not make any changes to borough or school district code, but it does back a rule, advanced at a statewide school board meeting last month, that would bar transgender girls from competing in high school girls' sports, and only allow girls assigned female at birth to compete. The rule would create a new division for students that, quote, identify with either sex or gender. That proposed rule is open to public comment through July 26th, when the state board could vote on whether to adopt the rule. Kenai Assemblymember Richard Dirkvorkian introduced the resolution in support of that rule. By the time it reached the Assembly for a vote Tuesday night, the resolution had almost half a dozen sponsors, including the borough mayor and member Tyson Cox.
Okay, girls have worked very hard to have these teams and to have their own teams and to be able to play competitively.
Nationally, bans like the one on the table in Alaska have been part of a broader trend to restrict the rights of trans kids and adults. At the Assembly meeting, many speakers, including Dennis Murray, insisted their support was about fairness in school sports.
This is about fairness and safety, and I think that that girls should have a chance to compete against girls.
Spoken and written public comment leaned in support of the resolution, but some of those who testified said it was a non-issue, or that it was creating one out of nothing. Then Kelly, a member of the school board, said the resolution harms a segment of the student population.
This isn't merely a fear-based solution to a non-existent problem. It is the problem.
Board of Education President Debbie Carey questioned why the Assembly was weighing in on a school-related issue without notifying the district, and said the district is weighing in on more pressing issues, like funding, staff retention, and learning loss. Michelle Vasquez, speaking against the resolution, said only one trans girl has competed in high school athletics in the state.
This seems to be a solution in search of a problem, and I don't get the necessity of it.
Vasquez also encouraged the Assembly to think about the message the resolution would send to trans students who have disproportionately high suicide rates. Assembly President Brent Johnson, who said he has a trans child, said the mental health struggles among trans youth are no joke, but he ultimately supported the resolution, citing fairness. The resolution passed 6-2 with one absence. It will now be transmitted to the governor, the statewide Board of Education, the Kenai Peninsula Board of Education, and other groups. In Soldotna, I'm Riley Board.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you would like to play an integral part in what you're listening to, public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. If you are already a member or corporate sponsor, thank you. If you'd like to learn more about how to become a member or sponsor, it's easy. Start with a call to your public radio station. Planning today for a gift down the road builds a legacy of support for the media you treasure. Thank you for considering this public radio station in your estate planning. You can talk to your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. Thank you.
The Alaska Division of Air Quality issued its first smoke alert of the year for Southeast Alaska this morning. The region will be impacted by smoke from wildfires raging just over the Canadian border. As of last Friday, traces of smoke became visible across Alaska, but the winds have shifted and the fires have gotten worse. The division expects this will push a lot more smoke into the state over the course of the week. The smoke alert shows the air quality level for the entire panhandle from Skagway to Ketchikan dropped from good to moderate, it could even fall to unhealthy before the weekend. That means the concentration of smoke could affect public health. Sensitive groups like children, the elderly, and people with heart or lung diseases could experience health consequences from the smoky air. The state says people belonging to any of those groups should reduce prolonged or heavy exercise outdoors. Conditions in Canada support more wildfires and smoke for at least the next week. The State Division will issue its next report Saturday morning if the air does not improve. There's a new member of the University of Alaska Fairbanks Police Department. Officer Yogi is an explosives detection dog. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Yogi is a 15-month-old chocolate Labrador retriever, and despite his vest and badge, he's definitely not scary. His partner, UAF Police Officer Jill Copeland, says Yogi is different from the typical law enforcement canine.
He's super friendly, so he could be social. He does not apprehend suspect as far as biting or anything like that. He is strictly explosives detection at this point.
Officer Copeland says she worked with police dogs in the lower 48 before joining the UAF department last summer.
And so I kind of brought it up to our chief here, ask if I could maybe write a proposal to start a program. I think it's super beneficial for the college. And I found out during my research that Interior Alaska does not have any other explosive dogs other than what's in the military, and they're not always available. So I kind of came up with a proposal, and we have a ton of support within the university and the community.
Copeland says Yogi was purchased for $12,500 from K2 Solutions in North Carolina.
And I actually used to work for that company, so I was kind of familiar with how they train their dogs, and it's really solid, so that's why I went with them. But we went there, and we picked him, and we did all these tests with him to test his drive, which is like, you know, his motivation to work and find things, and he just blew every other dog out of the water that I looked at.
Copeland says Yogi knows the scent of a dozen explosive chemicals, but for him, detection is a game.
When I smell this certain scent, I get my toy.
Copeland trained and certified with Yogi when she picked him up in North Carolina last month and brought him back to Fairbanks, where he made his public debut at the Midnight Sun Run. Copeland says Yogi can scan for explosives in a variety of environments and circumstances on and off campus.
We have a lot of dignitaries, a lot of researchers, and everyone come in, and lots of events, runs, and I think since I've been here, we've had a couple suspicious packages. We just worked the Carlson Center, the Chris Young concert. So it's like the more stuff we do, the more, you know, I hope people realize we're here as a resource for them.
Copeland says she's looking forward to the return of students who will have the opportunity to be involved in Yogi's ongoing training, which she demonstrated at the police station.
Are you ready? Go find it. Find it.
Yogi made short work of the explosive detection test.
Yes, very good, buddy!
And was rewarded with a toss of his favorite toy, a tennis ball. Yogi's future training will also include tracking and search and rescue. After less than 2 months together, Copeland and Yogi already have a strong bond at work and off duty when Yogi lives with Officer Copeland and her family. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska is one of the only places in the world where peony flowers grow in the summer months. But the unusually cold, wet weather this year is delaying the blooms by weeks, and peony farmers say they have had to cancel the bulk of their early season orders, leading to lost revenue. But as Alaska Public Media's Tim Rocky reports, some are hopeful that they'll be able to make up for their losses at the end of the season.
Martha Lajeski looks out over nearly an acre of peonies at her farm just north of Willow. Thousands of round green buds are standing between 3 and 4 feet tall, and that's a problem.
It's cold, wet, gray, miserable.
In a typical year, this field is filled with flowers, not rounded bulbs that have yet to bloom. Lajeski manages sales for the Alaska Peony Cooperative, a group of 6 farms that ships and sells about 50,000 stems per year. In a typical year, the first harvested blooms would be used in weddings by early July. But the first order shipped just this week, far behind schedule.
Even until like May, I was booking orders to ship on July 5th. And then it stayed cold, it stayed wet. Our plants were just not maturing. They weren't coming out of the ground. We had a late snow melt. Of course, we had lots of snow this winter. So it was just like one factor after another was compounding on the delayed start to the season.
Lijewski is not alone. For South Central Alaska, cold and wet weather has put a damper on the start to summer, which is the region's coldest since 2008. And Lijewski says that most Alaska peony cooperative farms only began harvesting last week, 3 weeks behind schedule. She says that means tens of thousands of dollars in lost revenue already this summer. Alaska has about 200 commercial growers, including Michael Williams, who owns Eaglesong Lodge near Squetna with his wife. They started growing peonies in 2009 after invasive northern pike knocked out the salmon population near the lodge where they would guide fishing trips.
Alaska has so many microclimates that are conducive to peonies. And basically, that's how the industry has started, and that's how we have progressed.
The long summer days and cold winter temperatures in the state make Alaskans the only farmers in the world that can produce fresh peonies during the summer months. But Williams says this year is different. He's had to cancel the first 2 weeks of orders, most of which were headed to the lower 48.
We can only handle this weather, oh, I don't know, maybe another couple of weeks, and we're in uncharted territory right now. We've not had such a late season before.
Peony farmers in interior Alaska are faring better, though. Dave Russell and his wife started Boreal peonies in Two Rivers in 2012 and have become the largest producer in the state.
We're now basically the only player in the game until New Zealand starts and Chile starts in October. And so this year, the window, we've hit the window perfectly.
Russell says that temperatures on sunny days have stayed around 70 degrees, just cool enough not to overheat his flowers. He says that's helped his plants grow bigger and brighter than ever before. And he thinks, ultimately, the weather will benefit South Central peony producers later in the season.
By mid to late July, there is nothing available except what comes out of Alaska. And so if it's cooler, which it is down there, I know they're 2 to 3 weeks behind this year, it's absolutely in their best interest because there is no other competition that's out and about at that point.
Russell said that in recent years, soot from nearby wildfires has plagued his flowers with fungus and mold. Last year, Russell says he lost over a quarter of his plants during a hailstorm.
If I've learned nothing else in farming up here, no year is average.
At Martha Lijewski's farm in Willow, they're still behind schedule, but hoping that the late season sales will allow them to make up for lost time. In Anchorage, I'm Tim Rocky.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Rhonda McBride and Liz Ruskin in Anchorage, Riley Board in Kenai, Shelby Herbert in Petersburg, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde. Tim Rocky is our producer, and he's on the peony beat. I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Air Cargo, providing Gold Streak Express shipping for urgent deliveries throughout Alaska, with connections to more than 100 destinations in the lower 48 and Hawaii. More at alaskacargo.com.
Support for public radio comes from the communities we serve. Whether you give as an individual member or through your business, know that your contribution makes possible programming that informs, inspires, and entertains. We thank you for the role you play in your public radio station. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.